Comrade, I'll start by quoting a conference resolution of ours, I think 3 years ago, by way of definition. He says, the central notion of reformist ideology is the belief that it is possible for working people, by collective action of some kind or other, to solve some problems, to improve conditions and so on, within the basic framework of the existing social structure. Now, I start out with that. I know it sounds a bit formal and so on. I mean, quite clear what we are actually talking about. That idea, the idea summarized in that rather pompous language, actually is immensely powerful. Immensely powerful. And if we don't understand that, we will grossly underestimate the real sources of support of our opponents in the working class movement. Why is it immensely important, influential rather? It is immensely influential because it corresponds to the life experience of very large numbers of people, millions and millions in the developed capitalist countries anyway. Of course, it's not an on and on, up and up, forever and ever process. You can have a Hitler, you can have a Pinochet, the working class movement can be smashed, things can go backwards and so on and so forth. Nevertheless, the experience, not necessarily this, that or the other individual, but the working class as a whole, is that actually it is possible by various means within the framework of the system, by trade union organisation, by a party which claims to be a left party, the Labour Party and so on, to get some results. Now actually, for that to be valid, not for this or that person, but for the millions, there must be some results. And we have to say, second starting point, actually there have been. Now we talk quite rightly at present about the Tory offensive, you know, which has been going on ever since Thatcher came in. Before Thatcher, it was started by the last Labour government, cut back on some of the reforms gained in the past, cuts in the health service, etc., etc., redundancies and so on and so forth. Well, that's right, yeah, as a reaction. Nevertheless, where we are now, Tory cuts, unemployment and all the rest of it, is a great deal further on than when I was a lad. And when some of you were young, come on, you don't have to be that old. It is true that this is possible under certain conditions. How is it possible? Next important thing, reforms are always a product of struggle. It's the process of the class struggle. Nor is it necessary that a reformist party, for example, is in power implementing these reforms. On the contrary, their opponents can be induced to implement reforms if the level of struggle is relatively high in order to buy off, to confess, and so on and so forth. The point is often made, actually, by more intelligent Tory party speakers. Perhaps you haven't heard one, but there are one or two, actually. But actually, if you look back at the various social gains that have been made in the course of the 20th century, they say the majority, which is an exaggeration, but it's true. A very large number of legislative changes of importance have been introduced by Conservative governments, or Liberal governments earlier. Why? Why? Actually, the idea would never enter their heads, but for a high level of class struggle. I will illustrate this by looking briefly at the history. The first big break in terms of legislative concessions for working people, votes of power, leave aside the vote, although it's worth pointing out that here it was a Tory government that first gave some working people the vote. Why did they do it? 1867. Not, of course, because they thought, oh, it's poor workers or something like that. They ought to have the vote. Nice, responsible people. By hell, they had come to the conclusion that it was impossible to maintain for much longer the 1832 settlement, which gave the middle classes the vote, and incidentally took the vote away from that small number of workers who had it before 1832. It was impossible to sustain. And because of the rising campaign and so on and so forth, actually, they decided, all right, We can't stop it. We'll do it. Take the credit. Steal the opposition's clothes, etc., etc. And there wasn't even a Labour Party at the time. But much more recently, you see, you look at the 20th century, elementary things. Unemployment benefit. Old age pensions. Now, all right, you can argue about the rates. That goes on all the time. The class struggle goes on all the time. But the truth is we take them for granted. How were they achieved? They were not achieved by a Labour government. No Labour government was in office at the time. They were the product of a very sharp rise in the class struggle in Britain in the period between about 1910-1914. And they all came in a bunch, one after another, very, very quickly. Massive expansion of trade union organisation, big strikes, first national miners' strike, the first national rail strike, and so on and so forth. Semi-insurrectionary conditions and the transport strike, particularly in Merseyside. Must be something wrong in Merseyside, you know, they're always up to something or other. But seriously, these concessions, well, the answer of the ruling class, or its more intelligent sections, through the then dominant party, the Liberal Party, bourgeois party, to attempt to do what? First of all, to diffuse immediate discontent. But then there is something else. And this something else is very important. Once you have got relatively stable, permanent working class organisation, let's be clear what we mean by that. I don't mean it doesn't rise in numbers or shrink in numbers or anything like that, but relatively permanent, large scale working class organisation, it is necessary for the ruling class to intervene in the politics of the working class organisations. Now then, it is not, generally speaking, their main method to organise their own people, you know, like, what is it called? Something Association of Tory Trade Unionists? Still exists. We were now, we always have a speaker at Tory Party conference, good bit of tokenism. No! Their main method is something else. Permanent, large scale working class organisations inevitably gives rise to the labour bureaucracies. It is a fact of life. The two things go together. The gain and the disadvantage. And the intervention, both in practical terms and above all in terms of ideology, is through these layers. Recent experience, last week, Walton by-election. For 2-3 weeks before, throughout the campaign, virtually the entire media, television as well as press, including papers who normally wouldn't give a by-election more than a paragraph after the result was announced, they're all intervening vigorously. Who are they supporting? The Tory candidate? No. They knew he'd been beaten by an Alsatian dog in a previous election. They knew he wasn't a runner. Not even seriously, the Liberal Democrats. No, the overwhelming thing was attack the so-called real Labour candidate, Leslie Marmoud. Who do you support implicitly, even when they didn't say it outright, and it sticks in the gullet of the people who write for the Daily Telegraph to say it actually in so many words? Vote for Kinnock's man. Now, this kind of intervention goes on all the time, particularly, however, when there are possibilities, or it seems to the rulers that there are possibilities, that the right wing in the labour movement, which rests in the end of the day on the trade union bureaucracy and their petty bourgeois and bourgeois allies in Parliament, might be weakened. Let us take another recent example. The example is not recent, but the case has rumbled on. The whole business of Scargill and the NUM funds and the big campaign by the Daily Mirror and the television and all these rogues about how Scargill in effect fiddled the funds. They were careful not to say that in so many words, because that is actually libelous. But that's the implication of a tremendous campaign. Why? This is after the miners' strike, long after the miners' strike. Why? It's an attempt to strengthen the right in the working class movement and so on. And it's a serious thing. Therefore, all the time, you have Given large-scale and stable working-class organizations, you have, as total, in terms of ideas, in terms of practice, also within the working-class movement. Now, having said that, some people draw conclusions which, you know, they like to think in good, round, simple terms. Talk about union terms, very simple. Another lousy settlement, another sellout, what the hell? Why do we need the union anyway, etc., etc., or let's set up a nice new model union or what have you. Now we have to say, first of all, in terms of ideas, reformism, as I defined it, has a progressive content. It is a progressive idea, as a matter of fact, relatively progressive, that by collective action, working people can achieve gains for themselves, as opposed to winning the pools, marrying a millionaire, or rising out of your class, etc., etc. It is a progressive idea. It has a progressive concept. Of course, at the same time, the negative features of reformism, the conservatism of the reformist leaders, the fact that at the end of the day, in any crisis, they will always back the ruling class. Let's go back to 1985. Hardly a revolutionary crisis, by the way, but nevertheless, the miners' strike was a serious class confrontation, which is very important for the government, the bosses, and the right wing of the TUC and the Labour Party to win, right? No question about it. They were able to achieve their ends through the right wing of the Labour movement, through the TUC, and so on and so forth. Now then, the two sides are inescapable. I don't think I've put that very clearly. I'm not satisfied with it myself, so I'll start and say it again in different words. Working class organisation is a game. Even if you think what a lousy lot the leadership happens to be and so on, is a game. Working class organisation, which is inherently associated with reformist ideology, I mean, you can't get people to join anything unless you say, actually, there are good, sound reasons for supposing this will do you some good. Working class organisation also, however, has this built-in negative feature, and it is under those conditions that revolutionaries have to operate, at least when there are conditions of legality. We want conditions of legality. I don't know how many people have looked at Trotsky's writings on Germany, you know, the arguments of the German CP, which at that time a very ultra-left tack. They argued, actually, social democracy, which controls the unions too, most of them, they're very little different from Hitler. Social fascists, all this rubbish. It doesn't actually matter very much if they are smart. On the contrary, he argued, this heritage of organisation, of structure, warts and all, right wing and all, bureaucracy and all, nevertheless, is a conquest of the German working class, he said, made over 60 or 70 years. And that remains the case. Now, we have a problem then, don't we? On the one hand, everything strengthens new, you know, to speak, you know, in contemporary terms, tends to weakness. Yes? Everything strengthens him inside the movement, and he's bound to be strengthened inside the movement the more successful he is generally. On the other hand, we are part of that movement in the broad sense, and we go up and down, not automatically and simply, but broadly speaking, as that movement goes up and down. Working class movement goes forward, and most spectacularly in recent years, of course, in the first half of the 70s, we went forward fast. Working class movement goes backwards, then it's much harder for us. Much, much harder. Problem of operation. Here we have to come to the question of the distinction between left and right reformists. Now look, there are no black and white distinctions in this field, any other. Left and right are relative terms. The people who now constitute the right wing of the Labour Party were, most of them, most of the individuals who have come, not all of them, not Roy Hattersley, but most of them were regarded as pillars of the left 7 or 8 years ago. And it's not simply a question of them changing over. It's where the centre of gravity is, where the whole centre of gravity of the thing is. The fact of the matter is that the distinctions between left and right are important to us, both in union terms and in political terms. Let us take the question of the Walton by-election. Not because I think it's the most important thing in the world, but it just happened. It's important in that sense. Now, to me, it is obvious that anyone who has got any gut feeling at all, you know, working class feeling, the Labour movement and so on, should support, well, whatever criticisms you want to make, you know, we'll come to that later, but come on, actually support the left-wing candidate, Mahmood, against that stone-faced apparatchik kilfoil that they put on. Yeah, I mean, it's so obvious. I mean, even without thinking about it, I wouldn't have to think about it, you know? And I think lots of people wouldn't. You come to that conclusion automatically. You look at them and you say, good God, there. No question. Now, is that just an emotional spasm? No, it is not just an emotional spasm. You see, we ask, how actually do we hope to gain and try to gain at the expense of the reformers? Not just gain people, individuals, but gain influence and so on and so forth, build the organisation in numbers, but above all in influence. Actually, the whole argument rests on being able to establish some kind of common activity with some of them. People, sometimes, some people are convinced by ideas. Well, if they're not, I ought to sit down and shut up because I'm wasting my time and yours. But people on a large scale are not typically really convinced about fundamentals simply by arguments. They're convinced by experience. As I said, the power of reformist ideas actually depends on the fact that to some considerable extent that the central notion coincides with the life experience of millions. It is, through joint activity, through struggle, the so-called United Front approach. I'll say something more about that in a moment, but basically that type of approach is fundamental to our work. Of course we argue with people, of course we sell a paper, very important, carry out propaganda activities of all kinds, but centrally, it is necessary to engage with some of them. On what conditions? On those issues where what they say, never mind whether they mean it or not, what they say and what we say about an issue actually coincide. Otherwise, very, very difficult to develop any joint activity. It will always be difficult. Always difficult, always opposed by the right wing. Hence, it is peculiarly the left reformists in the first instance that we attempt this kind of operation with very, very varying degrees of success. You see, I think Cliff said this on, when was it? Sunday, I think. He's talking about Trotsky and the Fourth International. Excellent ideas, no forces. I mean, that's a crude summary, and it's right. You cannot jump over your own head. You have to have a certain level of leverage, certain numbers, so that you can twist arms. Otherwise, you know, if you're the flea on the elephant, that's it. You know, no matter how good your theses or your program, as someone would say, actually, it makes not a damn bit of difference unless you are able to exercise some leverage. Now, we are somewhat better able to do that than we once were. But still, we have to look at the relationship with forces. It would be absolutely daft for us to say, come on, get rid of the Tories, want a joint campaign, us and the Labour Party. We address the leaders of the Labour Party saying, join, you know, together, form the agreement. So they simply say, piss off. And they, if they bother to reply, they'll say, piss off. Perhaps they'll even bother to reply. And for a very good reason. The very good reason is, they know damn fine that in electoral terms they're a giant and we're a dwarf. We're worse than the dwarf. We're an insect. you know, by comparison. But that is not true when it comes to a thing like paying the poll tax. Again, it's everything. Although they can win all the votes, Union Congress nearly all the votes, and so on and so forth, actually sections of their supporters and others, sections of their supporters and others, prove, actually, given initiative, willing to take part in anti-poll tax activities, to refuse to pay, etc., etc., etc. Now, that kind of activity is fundamental to us. It means that all the time we have to be looking at those issues which, or the opportunities, those issues were actually, they say, we're against, they did say, the Labour Party officially said, we're against the poll tax. Good, that was our starting point. Without that, actually, it's much more difficult for you. So this whole question of a united front approach. Now, you know, none of this is new, as some people well know. It's necessary to discuss it again, because it is quite possible that in, possibly, the end of this year, before the end of this year, but quite certainly before July the 9th, isn't it, 1992, there's going to be a general election. And we will have the perennial problem of what do we say. Now, I know what we're going to say, because I'm pretty sure we've got the majority, but that's not enough. And there's always an argument about this. What we have traditionally said is vote Labour without illusions or some such qualification, and then gone on to attack the record of the Labour Party, don't expect this, don't expect that, but vote Labour, yes. Because the general argument, actually a swing to the from the Labour Party to the Tories, however, whatever you think of Kinnock, and I think very little, actually in objective terms is a swing to the left. It is advantageous to us. It is a gain for the workers' movement. At the same time, it reinforces those elements in the working class movement which are most hostile to us. There is no gain without loss. Now, let's go through it. The worst time, I think, was 1970. Some people remember this, lots more, doesn't matter. We'd had a Labour government in since 1964. Then came the 70 election. This was the first Harold Wilson government. It was a lousy Labour government. It backed the United States war in Vietnam up to the hilt, hypocritically, of course. Naturally, we're for peace and so on. That's what the United States is fighting for, you know. So, absolutely disgusting. Smashed, or tried to smash. They didn't smash. That's not correct. They smashed a national seamen's strike, and they did their damnedest to smash the seamen's union. Harold Wilson, the Prime Minister, on television, ranting on about these Reds, communists. Stalinists haven't moved so far to the right then, you see, as they subsequently did. Not very plausible now, is it? Actually running the union. And what did he call them? Oh, yes. A tightly knit group of politically motivated men manipulating these innocent seamen. The seamen are not interested, you understand, really, in reduced hours. They were horrendous hours or increased pay or anything like that. These Reds are manipulating. I mean, it's that sort of government. It was an exceedingly reactionary government. There's absolutely no question about it. And so, when we were much smaller then, and we had been growing quite rapidly, so we had a lot of new members, we had a hell of an argument about what do you say? And the argument that there is really no difference, no significant difference between Labour and Tory, became important. I want to go through it. Is there a significant difference in terms of policy? Broadly speaking, no. No. There may be in words, that's a different matter. But actually, I ask myself, we get rid of this lot, let's suppose this lot are defeated and so on, and we have, instead of Norman Lamont, we have John Smith, and instead of, what is the man? Oh yes, a rather smooth talking upper class man from Eton, what's he called? Douglas Hurd. We have that creature Kaufman. I can't remember. Turns me off every time I see him on the telly. But and instead, of course, of Major, we have Neil Kinnock. In policy terms, how the economy is run or not run, basically the attempt to control, to restrict, to drive down, if they can get away with it, real earnings. Trade union reform? You must be joking. because the left in the working class movement at the moment is relatively very weak, they do not even need to promise to abolish the Tory anti-union laws. They did last time, of course, not did they? They promised. They had to do it, because such was the pressure from below, the strikes and so on and so forth. Not this time, no. The people who say there is no difference are essentially right in present circumstances, if by no difference you mean no difference in policy terms. But actually, there is something else. It is called working class consciousness. And that is what we have to relate to. Yeah? And in those terms, the argument that you sit down, general election going on, media's full of it and so on, we sit down and say, don't make any difference, comrades, but what's a football? Or what have you? I mean, that's, you know, actually, to take that position, insofar as you're operating in the working class movement, is to guarantee a reduction of your influence. Now, don't misunderstand me. There are some people who will agree with you in the workers' movement. Yes, oh no, no doubt about it at all. I've met them often. Are they the best elements? No, typically they're the worst elements. That is the brutal truth. Therefore, we have to align ourselves with the left against the right, even in broad national terms, even though the left is run by the Labour Party, and everything that is run by a bunch of scoundrels. We have to align ourselves, and therefore we have to swallow hard, and it takes some doing for some of us, and say, yes, actually, we've got to argue, and not whisper at the bottom of the page, we've got to say, loudly and clearly, we are for the victory of the Labour Party in a general election, and then we must criticise their record, their policies, and so on. Above all, we must not create illusions in them. We must create, the illusions exist. We must not reinforce the illusions. Two other points, small points, and then somebody else can talk. When I say we must support the Labour Party in a general election, the same thing is true broadly in any election, by-election or what have you, this does not mean that, like certain individuals, as far as I can see, have simply lost their bottle, that if when a left-wing Labour candidate is standing here, the right-wing one, as in Bolton, you say, oh, come on, Labour to power must support the Labour Party, so we bought Kim Boyle. Obviously, this is a nonsense. You ask yourself, who are you trying to relate to? Actually, we're not trying to relate to the mafia around Kilfoyle. The relationship between them and us, if he had any power, thank God he doesn't have any power, would be a physical one, I'm quite sure. He strikes me, I look at him, I think that's a prime candidate for the head of Kimmett's personal Stasi, if he had one, thank God he doesn't. No, the people we are trying to relate to are precisely the people who do have reformist illusions, but who also have some gut feeling, who are in a certain sense to the left. Therefore, no nonsense about we never support candidates against the Labour Party. The argument is the strategic argument, we support the Labour Party against the Tories, not against the left. And the other argument is really perhaps best left. It's just occurred to me, because I want to stop at that point. I mean, I want to start the discussion at that point. It's best left to come out in the discussion. I'm sorry. Good. What are you going to say?
Right, comrades, we've got about half an hour for discussion. Before I start to call speakers, if Colin Sparks is here, could he go to 2G immediately, please? Right, there's a comrade there. Which we were arguing about again last night, it's just a question of voting for things like Tory government. We've had an argument like over and over again, and the argument comes down to the Labour Party the representation of its organic link to the working class, Tory Communist Party being essentially nationalism. And then People, you know, we've more or less got this sort of dodged out. Remember the question led me when Moose came up? And what people say is we vote for Mappin because she's actually connected to the struggle, she's actually representing the fight back. You know what Duncan was saying about actually sticking your gullet to vote for Kilfoyle while there's someone saying the fight back. And this is what the argument went back on the agenda, because people saying, well, come on, it. The plague councillors were standing to saying, you know, you don't pay your poll tax, the plague councillors are speaking against the Gulf one, the plague councillors are doing this, that, and the other. And I think that, I mean, I've been arguing about it with two people, I don't think I particularly won the argument. I was really wondering what people were actually saying.
Come over at the back there.
Yeah, Carly's my turn, so I'm going to do these things. A different argument. Whenever we have a branch meeting where we talk about different labour movements across the world, you know, the possibilities of revolution, a standard argument comes up, which I take on particular side of and I haven't really resolved, and I'm not particularly clear, so this might be confusing. That is, someone will say, we're talking about India. There's no Labour Party in India. That makes the revolution easier, comrade. At this point, me and a couple of other people stick our hands up and say, there's no Labour Party in India. That means there's not so much working class consciousness in that country that have actually developed into a reformist party in that country. That is a weakness in the Labour movement. That happens every time we have a meeting that comes upon the question. And it usually stops there. We rarely resolve the situation. And I want to try and use this opportunity to get down to other people to help clear it up. It seems to me that Labour parties, the reformist parties like the Labour Party across the world, are a reflection of the working class consciousness that breaks from the ruling class to some degree or other, that says we need specific class objectives to be achieved. And the growth of reformist parties, although the Labour Party was born out of defeat of the working class, not out of victory, was nonetheless a reflection of that. And therefore, it isn't the case that having reformist parties is full stop an obstruction to the class, it's a reflection of the class. Now, except at the same time, as Comrade say that when it comes to revolutionary struggles, reformist organisations then stand in the way. There's an attempt to blur the class distinctions and prevent the revolutionary struggles. But recent articles in the paper and in Irish Socialist Worker about elections in Ireland have been talking about how a developing class consciousness has been reflected in growth of at least the vote for the reformist parties in Southern Ireland. And that seems to be something that is healthy and something we should be pleased about. People are starting to look in that direction, however confused, starting to develop reformist class consciousness. But what then tends to happen out of that argument in our branch is that we end up in discussing whether workers will go through reformist ideas in revolutionary struggles. People tend to accept that when there's very little going on, reformist ideas make sense. But when we have explosions of revolutionary struggle in any particular country, the question is then, will workers have any reformist ideas, or will they go from whatever particular weak, backward ideas they have in various different countries to immediate revolutionary ideas? And I think that's wrong. I think that the experience of various revolutions, I've been reading about the Russian Revolution again recently, is that the workers might have formed the Soviets, but they formed the Soviets and still accepted the existence of the provisional government. You know, the dominant political force inside the Soviets, which the workers voted for, said we need workers and the ruling class running society. There's a confusion still, a blur. Although the workers had sensed their power, it hadn't focused completely out on the working class power alone. And that workers will go through reformist ideas, and our task will be to fight alongside them. And not believe that when we get a revolutionary struggles anywhere, the workers will go from nothing to revolution, to basically Bolshevism overnight. That may be unclear, but that's certainly in respect to what's going on in our branch.
Thank you. Mark Franker.
Yeah, I wanted to say a little bit about Bolton, because it's one of the myths, I think, that surrounds what some of the arguments have been confronted with, is that really what the argument about in the Labour Party is about is an argument for witch hunting the left and kicking them out of the Labour Party. Actually, it's much deeper than that. It's about a Labour government, or the possibility of a Labour government, having to attack its own base and making sure it can control the workforce. In Bolton, one of the arguments we're continually facing by some people is, oh, well, you and the SWP, at least you're honest. Not like those militant people, you know, half in, half out. They wanted to blow up to be out there. You think they're mad? You haven't seen anything yet when you've seen the Socialist Workers' Party, actually, in terms of what we really represent, in terms of a fight against the system and a fight against a Labour government. Because I think it's important to put it in that context. Because, you know, otherwise people can fall into the trap of saying, you know, is it really about the nature of the way the left is organised, etc. Actually, what the witch hunt of the left is about the Kinnock a potential Kinnock government trying to undermine the possibility of struggle against him. I'll tell you, I think one of the things that came out of the by-election was you got the feeling that when, you know, Trump was talking about the way all the press rounded on Leslie Mahmood, one of the things you get is, what is it about? Is it about really merely getting to the left of the Labour Party? No. I think it's about, because I'll tell you, the biggest threat to the Labour Party is an alternative outside. And I think they know that. That's one of the reasons they wanted to smash the left. And, you know, the press in unison did an effective job in their terms. If you measure electoral terms, obviously you'd be quite demoralised by it. But, you know, of what they were terrified about, they are terrified, I think, of an alternative outside Labour. By their logic, you know, they should be happy that all the left leave. If the left leave the Labour Party and try and build an alternative, I tell you, they're more of a threat to the Labour Party leadership. So a couple of other things briefly, which is that really, you can see that absolutely concretely. I mean, there's quite funny stories involved. One of them is, you know, some of our comrades, we were out canvassing and arguing on the doorstep for voting for them to move and building an alternative. You know, you find your ball with these people taking photographs of left wingers, including Albie down here, a comrade of ours, and it's really, you could see the way the Labour left were reacting, was hilarious, worried about getting out of the Labour Party. It was quite simple for our comrades when the cameras came around, and Albie was telling me about, it was one simple response to the camera, they saw a mobile phone that would be a photograph of someone that would be attempting to kick out the Labour Party, going like this, to Peter Kill's boy. We don't have a particular problem about being kicked out of the Labour Party. However, more seriously, in terms of the argument we've got with people, I think there's a very important role. Duncan talked about physical confrontation. I'll tell you, when you read about GBH, and you hear some of the stories that came out of the thing, and I remember from it, John Carr was telling me out on the streets again the other Sunday in Walton, really one of the Kill Balls was coming up and saying, I'll tell you the one way to solve this, let's go around the corner. You know, I'll take you around the corner, that's one way to resolve it. You get the understanding that actually it's not just about a mere grant, but what the reality of a Labour government can be about, what they're prepared to do, what they're prepared to get up to. And I think we need to understand that what Walter really represents is every person who's prepared to back an alternative to Labour to the left. It's like insurance. If you like, they're the people that actually win the vanguard of arguing that actually you can, you know, when the Kinnock government comes in attacking workers, when people are confused and say this is our people attacking work, you know, this is our government attacking workers, there will be at least a minority of people, we don't know how big it will be, the 2,600 isn't a bad starting point, who will oppose that government from the left. When you read what happened in 74, 79, there were whole numbers of intermediary organisations in between ourselves and the Labour government that would stall revolt against the Labour government. This time, that ballast, if you like, those organisations between us and Kinnock are less and less in existence. It means that every single one of those people, all the kind of people who think like that, we have to argue with. Yes, about we want to identify with Labour, but key arguing with really why desperately we need an alternative to make sure that what happened in 74, 79 doesn't happen again.
Next
speaker
stands for the comment here.
Yeah, I would like to develop some more of what Mark was talking about when he talked about the comments being faced with the cameras giving the two signals and not helping. Right, is that can now be speaking over the question of whether my main involvement. Inside our NGU, we've got a London Broad left, and that's quite left inside our NGU, from East London every month. And there's been a witch hunt inside the NGU of the London Broad left, and they actually, we had a really good discussion in the last meeting about signing back redundancies and signing over the pay claim, the 20,000 jobs went in Bright Hill from last year. And we came to a position at near the end of the meeting, and there wasn't much time left, but a lot of discussion, where we were going to put up a resolution over Leslie Mahmood and support Leslie Mahmood. So our comrades raised the resolution, put it forward, very good resolution. And Militant, the two leading Militant members inside this NCU brought a letter. And one of them, the leading member, stuck his hand up and said, well, comrades, I don't think we've got enough time to discuss this in any full detail. I'm quite worried to talk to comrades down in the bar, but I'm going to ask you that we don't have any discussion on this and we don't vote on it. And one of the other comrades inside the Broad Left went around and said, no, I think we should discuss this, and the chair said, okay, we'll give a half an hour, we're going to discuss it.
So we had a bit of a debate about it. Some people were arguing against it, and some people were arguing for it, you know. And it came down, we were going to decide whether to have a vote on it. I was looking for my special hand up again, because I personally will be going up to you others to support by the man moving forward. But I'm going to ask you that this meeting doesn't take a vote on it tonight. I'm going to ask you that we have a vote, whether we have a vote on the resolution. Quite, you know, and he says, if you lose the vote, whether we have the vote, I'm afraid I'm going to have to support the SWP moving the motion. Obviously, he didn't want to be seen that the London Borough left that he was involved in. The Labour Party members know him, to take his Labour Party branch. And another meeting that Millicent Spoh was in as well, just kept dumb. Never said a word about it, like, you know. And it ended up, they voted not to have a vote on the resolution, we lost, and we never even got to the position where we could vote on the resolution. And after I've been up and down the country that Millicent has refused to talk about it, into the branch, make resolutions about it, that they've actually been having supported Western Women involvement and everything else. So, I mean, I think for us, our comments, I think we could have used maybe pushing resolutions, both a number of comments, maybe that this time round they never raised the resolution, and I think we actually could have liked that, made a lot more political capitalising, because I think it was very important. There's a couple of questions I just wanted to put to Duncan. Western Mahmood said in the Guardian on Saturday that she's going to stand against Kilfoyle in the general election. I mean, what's her position of our comments going to be? You know, we always say in general elections, straight fight against the Tories, that we've always voted Labour with no illusions. Will there still be that link, that struggle, that fight there? Because I know there's a lot of branches that support Mahmood. And also, with this, what happened with Frank Field and his constituency, would really like to mean the Labour Party is trying to get out of the electoral college, moving to a situation of one person, one vote. It's going to be the case. As Eric Shepherd pointed out, he thinks it's an SDP mark too, and really they'll get rid of the electoral college, they'll get rid of that intrinsic link, and they'll really think things through again about voting Labour.